Well, thanks everyone for coming, braving the rain. As we say in California, where it never rains. And I'd really like to thank Stuart and Carolyn, James, and the rest of the Halifax Peace Coalition for inviting us and taking care of us while we've been visiting Halifax. And thanks, Stuart, for that nice introduction, setting the stage from the Canadian foreign policy perspective. I think the debate that's taking place in Canada about troops in Afghanistan is comparatively a sign of healthy democracy, at least relative to what's happening in the United States. I mean, at least here, there are actually members of the government, the NDP, recommending a pullout of Canadian troops from the current U.S.-led mission. In the United States, our so-called liberal opposition, which is exemplified by former presidential candidate Democratic Senator John Kerry, is that this opposition is deriding the Bush administration for not finishing the fight and recommends an increased number of troops, redeploying them from Iraq. So in the U.S., we have essentially a very narrow spectrum. We have on the right the right-wing U.S. administration saying everything's fine, we need more troops, and the left-wing opposition saying everything's horrible, but we need more troops. So the consensus among U.S. officials seems to be that the more troops there are in Afghanistan, the better the country will be. The consensus among the two major parties in the U.S. seems to be, at least, is being presented as one that says that the more troops in Afghanistan, the better. There are exceptions. And the better the country, Afghanistan will be in terms of security, ending violence, fostering stability in the country. But really, there is very little evidence to support that claim. In fact, all across Afghanistan, since 2001, we've seen a steady increase in foreign troops from about 23,000 troops at the end of 2001 to about 30,000 in mid-2006. Now, has this led to a more stable environment? Well, if you look at the number of attacks by non-state actors labeled terrorists, these attacks have increased dramatically during the same period. According to the European think tank, the Senlis Council, security is at its worst since 2001. Attacks are perpetrated on a daily basis. Several provinces, until recently quite safe, are now experiencing suicide bombings, murders, ambushes, and explosions. This is with more foreign troops than ever. There were, just looking at the statistics, there were about 5 such attacks per month in 2002. The number increased by a factor of 5 to 25 per month in 2005. And this July, there were over 100 such attacks. And this is directly attributable to the presence of non-Afghan forces operating under the rubric of the U.S.'s Operation Enduring Freedom. It's not my opinion, actually. This is the military's own assessment. James L. Jones, the commander of U.S. European Command and NATO's Supreme Allied Commander Europe, commented back in March that the upticks in violence are in part attributable to the fact that we're actually going to more places and taking the engagement to the enemy. So the very presence of foreign troops is causing a violent response. Why is that? Well, to answer that, we first have to look at the character of the foreign military operation. If you ask Prime Minister Harper, he recently commented that a suicide attack on 4 Canadian soldiers offering candy to Afghan children illustrates the evil that the troops are fighting and the goodwill and the nobleness of the cause that they are taking to the Afghan people. But when they're not giving out candy, the Canadian troops demonstrate their goodwill by being involved in NATO's Operation Medusa, leading this operation, as Stu told us, which killed, according to NATO's boasts, about 1,000 so-called Taliban militants. And we'll get to who these militants are later. This is in southern Kandahar province. In addition to killing 1,000, displaced over 20,000 others, non-militants. And the impression given in most NATO statements and propaganda and news coverage of NATO is that the troops are there for peacekeeping, as opposed to the U.S.'s Operation Enduring Freedom, but that's very disingenuous. While it's true that some troops from some countries are limited by what's called national caveats as to how aggressively they can go and kill Afghans, the majority of troops are continuing the U.S.'s operation Enduring Freedom, which is essentially an unaccountable war against guerrilla forces. Although now it's under a different name. It isn't mentioned very often in the media, but when pressed, U.S. generals admit that there's no distinction between the United States and NATO in Afghanistan. This is a quote from Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry, U.S.'s Combined Forces Commander in Afghanistan. For most NATO troops, the mission is going to be very much a U.S.-style operation. NATO spokesman James Aparatharai explained that ISAF forces will not be sent with one arm tied behind their backs. This is the common complaint among certain military circles with peacekeeping. And he continues, they can engage to defend their mission and to defend themselves. If that means they see a threat looming in the hills, they do not have to wait to be attacked and to take casualties. They can take action to defend themselves, including, if necessary, preemptively. To ensure that this U.S. approach is kept intact, a special command structure has been set up. While nominally the NATO mission is being run by the U.K., the deputy commander of security, meaning the commander in charge of the military, aggressive military operations, is what's called a dual-hatted U.S.-NATO military officer, Major General Benjamin Freakley. He answers to basically two generals, James Jones on the NATO side, NATO Supreme Commander, and John Abizaid, the guy responsible for Operation Enduring Freedom on the U.S. side. Both of these guys are U.S. generals, by the way. So in other words, the aggressive military activities that have become hallmarks of Operation Enduring Freedom, breaking down doors, airstrikes, terrorizing villages, indefinite detention and torture, these are going to continue under NATO, albeit with more troops contributed by Canada, Britain, and a few other countries who choose to go along with what the U.S. is doing. So who are the troops fighting? The threats looming in the hills. Well, the news media persist in relying on the label Taliban to denote the enemy of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. For example, just taken at random, an AP report September 16th said that 60 suspected Taliban militants attacked a police checkpoint on Friday. So why not just say 60 Afghans attacked a police checkpoint? I mean, it would be just as true, but it would actually imply that some regular Afghans not involved with the discredited Taliban might have a problem with the current situation in their country. A senior Western military official told the Washington Post, "We have killed a lot of Taliban, but they're not running out of foot soldiers. And for everyone we kill, we create new families that hate us." So this is a very crucial statement, I think. For everyone we kill, we create new families that hate us. This raises a couple of questions. Who are we killing, and why do families hate us? Are these all Taliban? There's, of course, no way of knowing for sure. There's no official Taliban uniform. The terminology that's used in the mainstream press forces you to limit anyone the United States and its allies might choose to kill to either the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. These are the two legitimate targets of U.S. violence in Afghanistan. After September 11th, 2001, a weak case was built for attacking those parties on the grounds of the atrocious human rights record of the Taliban and retaliation for 9/11. But today, the original Taliban regime no longer exists. According to the think tank, the Sendless Council, a significant number of the original Taliban militants were killed during Operation Enduring Freedom's initial phases, and the Taliban defeat was guaranteed by the defection of the many warlords to the U.S.-sponsored Northern Alliance. Since late 2001, the remnants of the Taliban have been based mainly in Pakistan and have been supported by a loose coalition. And among the coalition includes Afghans loyal to the former Taliban regime, disenchanted and nationalist Pashtuns, which is the largest Afghan ethnic group, religious conservatives, criminal gangs, opium traffickers, and a new generation of Pakistani and Afghan scholars. This is a new generation. So Senlis is calling this new coalition the Neo-Taliban. And finally, the remnants of the Taliban, related groups, and new insurgent actors currently operating in Afghanistan no longer have, this is according to Senlis, no longer have any clear ties to Al-Qaeda or an unambiguous relationship with those that carried out the September 11th attacks. In other words, the initial reason for U.S. invasion of Afghanistan is no longer valid. And the forces that are now being fought are in many cases completely new militants, not carrying some fanatical generic hatred of other cultures, but are the people that are angry with the Western troop presence in Afghanistan itself. So why would Afghan people be angry with NATO and the United States? Well, the United States government took advantage of what it thought was a blank check from the Afghan people to do essentially whatever it wanted in Afghanistan after 9/11. Unfortunately, they attended only to their own needs and interests. The U.S. operation was conducted with very limited goals, I would think. It looks like essentially the goals were limited to revenge for 9/11, the need to show a violent response when attacked, and maybe later the stated goal was the containment of Islamic fundamentalism, which the U.S. actions increase Islamic fundamentalism. But the Afghan people initially were extremely hopeful that the huge foreign interest in their country would provide enough money to help them to rebuild and to turn the clock back on warlordism and fundamentalism. Instead, the United States supported a return to warlordism by backing warlords to topple the Taliban and by preventing international peacekeepers from spreading throughout the country, real peacekeepers as opposed to war fighters. And now many warlords who are held back on their feet by Washington are now in the Afghan government. Over half of the Afghanistan's new parliament is either military commanders or religious conservatives. The U.S. promised reconstruction, and while some reconstruction was done, most of it was done in advance of the presidential elections in 2004, Afghanistan's elections, to bribe the people to vote for Washington's favorite, Hamid Karzai. Where are the highways the U.S. said it would build? Only one has been built so far, which is the Kabul-Kandahar highway. And it was all, by all accounts, it was a rush job, essentially built with a highly overpriced contract to an American contractor as opposed to an Afghan contractor. Where are the power plants that the U.S. said it would build, the water treatment plants? Most people in the capital, the most secure part of the country, don't even have running water, and most of them are lucky to have 3 hours of electricity per day. But there is a new Coke bottling plant in Kabul and a new 5-star hotel. Today, five years after 9/11, most Afghans essentially see the U.S. government as a government that's only in Afghanistan for its own interests, and those interests they don't coincide with those of the Afghan people. So it's important to see the violence that's happening as the result of a real lack of alternatives for the majority of Afghans. According to the Senlis report, current insurgents are Afghan people, and anti-government elements have been recruited from the growing number of people dissatisfied with the Karzai government or U.S. and NATO ISAF forces. The people are poor, they're insecure. They're forced to harvest opium to make a living. And more they're blaming the Americans and their allies for invading their country, for invading their villages, kidnapping and torturing civilians, bombing them, destroying poppy harvests, and working with warlords, essentially making life worse. The U.S. and its allies are now seen as the enemy by a large portion of the population in southern and eastern Afghanistan. The Washington Post quotes an anonymous Western diplomat saying, "Nearly 5 years on, there's no rule of law, no accountability. The Afghans know it is all a charade, and they see us as not only complicit, but actively involved." So I've been focusing mainly on the south where the foreign troops are located, but in the north there's also some cause for concern. The north of the country has been, up until now, basically the most stable region due to the iron-fisted control of the warlords who the U.S. helped back to power. According to the Washington Post, these commanders are said to virtually control daily life in many areas. Most of the warlords now support the central government of Karzai, but it looked like there may be rumblings of these warlords jockeying for a larger piece of the pie. The Post reports that some commanders appear to be gaining further strength as the Taliban threat draws closer and villagers seek powerful patrons to protect them. A Western diplomat told the Post, "In the North, they ask how they can be expected to disarm if the South is arming itself." Ethnic divisions are so deep in Afghanistan, the diplomat added, that if the Karzai government were to fall, civil war might resume almost immediately. And this points to the horrendous civil war that took place in the early 1990s, partly as a result of U.S. policy, where up to 50,000 Kabul residents were killed by rocket shellings by factions who were fighting over the city. Many of these factions had the backing of the United States and its allies. Now, but why would the Karzai government fail this and then lead to a civil war? Well, like his foreign backers, Karzai has essentially squandered the goodwill of the Afghan people. They elected him with a landslide in 2004. He got over 50% of the vote, compared to 16% for the second place Yunus Kanuni. About 75% of registered voters actually voted, so there's a huge turnout. It's an amazing achievement for a country that's withstood multiple coups, two foreign invasions, and one of the most violent civil wars in modern history, all in the last 30 years. But 1 year after the presidential elections, people were already jaded with Karzai's poor performance and his sycophantic following of Washington's lead, and only 50% of the electorate showed up for the parliamentary elections. People were starting to realize that essentially this newly imposed democracy was pretty futile. A 50-year-old tailor in Kabul named Mohammed John told the Washington Post that he returned to Afghanistan from Iran because we were told there was democracy. Instead, the old warlords are back. At night, people are robbed at home. In the day, they're robbed in the ministries. I feel cheated and full of sorrow. Ahmad Fahim Hakim, vice chairman of the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, told the New York Times that nothing Karzai promised has materialized. Beneath the surface, it is boiling. The Times goes on to say that the costs of Karzai's compromises are becoming harder to stomach for average Afghans and some foreign donors. Critics say the compromises have insulated many people from the benefits of democratic change. It's a euphemistic way of saying that the compromises are anti-democratic. Most recent among his compromises include the appointing of a powerful warlord with links to organized crime as the police chief of Kabul. And he also appointed newly appointed 13 other commanders to senior police posts in Kabul. This was a response to the Kabul riots of May, where a runaway American soldier's vehicle crashed into a crowd of Afghans and killed three. And then when the soldiers got out of the truck, instead of trying to placate the angry mob that resulted, they shot into the crowd and killing four more. So in response to the U.S. Crime in the city of Kabul, in the center of Kabul, Karzai appointed an organized crime leader to police chief to protect him from the riots, not to change U.S. policy. In another instance, the Afghan government is considering the reinstatement of the Taliban's feared religious police, the Department for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. Some of you may remember this. As I don't have to tell you, the implications for women in Afghanistan are pretty chilling. So, Karzai still has a little bit of subtlety, and in fact, he has to play his own crowd. So he understands, and he understands the source of the insurgency. So he has attempted to actually regain some support among his people with lukewarm criticisms of the foreign troop operations. This is only at home, as in contrast to what we've been seeing in the past couple of days in Karzai's recent visit. But in June, he said, "It's not acceptable for us that in all this fighting, Afghans are dying. In the last 3 to 4 weeks, 500 to 600 Afghans were killed. Even if they are Taliban, they are sons of this land." Karzai at that time urged a strategic reassessment of the fight against insurgents. But this wasn't probably was not taken very well by his foreign backers. An anonymous foreign military official is quoted in the Washington Post saying, "If Karzai attacks us, we can't help him project his vision. And if he goes down, we all go down with him." The speaker declined to be identified, but it's his reference to projecting Karzai's vision is similar to rhetoric used by the US and NATO, which the generals who say that their mission is to extend the authority of the Afghan government. But it was certainly not something the Bush administration wanted advertised, that Karzai and his backers were somewhat at odds. En route to Pakistan and Afghanistan, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice denied that such ideas were being considered, that her colleagues were actually critical of Karzai. She rejected the allegations that anyone was dissatisfied with Karzai's performance. She called him an extraordinary leader, declaring emphatically that the U.S. is going to back him and back him fully. Such statements certainly are going to help Karzai among his people, who already see him as a puppet of the Americans. But it has to be understood that Rice's claim that Washington will back him fully doesn't imply that Karzai's his recommendations are going to be taken seriously by the Bush administration. His critique of the military operation isn't something Rice is expected to follow up on with Bush or any other member of the administration. NATO spokesman James Apatharai made it clear that if NATO troops need to fight to extend the authority of the Afghan government, they will do it. They have the right to do it and will do it. So if they don't respect Karzai's own stated wishes, one wonders whose authority the NATO troops are actually extending. But it's likely that Karzai's anti-war statements are solely intended for his home audience, to regain some support among his population. When in the West, as we've been seeing, Karzai plays a completely different tune, as we saw yesterday in his deferential praise for Canadian troops in Afghanistan. I'd like to close by noting that, though, that his pleas, whether opportunistic or not, Karzai's concern with killing Afghans actually makes some sense from a tactical perspective, and you would imagine that someone who's intelligently going about a counterinsurgency war would be wise to change their policy. According to the U.S. Army's own counterinsurgency doctrine, the objective of counterinsurgency is to actually build the legitimacy of the government, which derives from the consent of the governed, whose willing support is required for the smooth running of that government. This U.S. doctrine is actually full of some interesting sayings, which the current U.S.-NATO mission, U.S.-NATO military establishment would find quite appalling. For example, "The more force used, the less effective it is." Or, "Sometimes doing nothing when attacked is the best reaction." Or, "The best weapons don't shoot." In short, don't make more enemies than through your actions than you already have. But I think whether or not the U.S.'s, these statements are a little too close to comfort, too close for comfort to prescriptions for actual democratic development in Afghanistan for the likes of Bush, Harper, and Blair, who, with the logic of a bully, see more violence as the only proper response to an insurgency. Thanks.